welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast for April 2009, a monthly roundup of news and information about legal developments impacting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a champion for student voices. We recognize the essential role that free speech and a free press play in a democratic society, and the SPLC is committed to nurturing and protecting those freedoms for the next generation. For more information about the center's work, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. Well, there are very few cases involving the First Amendment rights of student journalists that actually go all the way to court. And there are fewer still that result in any sort of a victory for the student media. And so even when there is a small and interim victory for the student media, it's a noteworthy event, and it's worth discussing and taking some time to explain. And that's what we would like to do today. Our guest joining us on this podcast, Robert Oxhorn, has firsthand experience with this case. He was a senior at the Ithaca High School in the Ithaca City School District in New York, and editor-in-chief of the newspaper The Tattler during the 2004-2005 school year, when a controversy erupted between the editors and the school administration over some editorial content decisions that the editors had made. This resulted in a First Amendment lawsuit, and just recently in a decision by a U.S. district judge that partially granted and partially denied summary judgment in favor of the school district on some of the students' claims. Before we turn to Robert and ask him to explain a little bit about the background to the case, just a minute's explanation on what it means when a judge takes up a summary judgment motion. When you have a case in federal court, it is very often the case that at the conclusion of the discovery process, that's after all of the witnesses have been questioned and all the documents have been exchanged, the defendant in the case will make a motion to the judge for summary judgment. This is a way of short-circuiting a jury trial. What it says to the judge is, we've now developed all the facts, we've now examined all the documents, and there is no issue that is worthy of submitting to the jury. It's a way for the judge legally to short-circuit a jury trial by taking some or all of the claims out of the hands of the jury. And indeed, that's what happened in this case in the decision of R.O. versus Ithaca City School District. A U.S. district judge issued an order on March the 24th in which he partially granted and partially denied the motion for summary judgment brought by the school district. And so, Robert, let's now turn the story over to you. And could you please explain a little bit about the facts that led us up to where we are today in court?
Sure. As a school newspaper, as a voice of the student body, we found ourselves at the center of expression for resistance to and discussion of these new policies and this new direction our school was heading in. We interviewed, you know, students that dressed up as nuns to protest the dress code. We ran a survey of students asking about this direction that Ms. Principal Jo Wilson was taking this school in, that found that two-thirds of students were uncomfortable with this direction. And all of this reporting we were doing was not making Principal Jo Wilson happy. And around this time, with all this criticism of the principal, he started trying to figure out ways that he could take over the paper, make sure that it was put under control, centralize it. Things came to a head in January of 2005 with the attempt to publish a cartoon about sex education to accompany an article about No Child Left Behind policies and health class sex education. And our advisor felt that this was inappropriate for the paper and decided that it should not be published. This was right after the school district had announced a new set of guidelines for the paper that transformed it from a from an open forum for student expression. And there's language in the school conduct manual that's the language of Tinker v. Des Moines that makes that point, the point that we are the sort of open forum, we think, pretty clear. And these new guidelines transformed us into what was clearly a paper under the Hazelwood v. Kuhlmeier restrictions on student press freedoms. And it went beyond that to include restrictions that would probably not be legally permissible under either standard.
Yeah. For example, the guideline said that the faculty advisor had to be given a list of every single story idea and every single story assignment and had to approve every assignment in advance, which might very well not even pass constitutional muster under the more restrictive Hazelwood standard.
We took this cartoon censorship as an opportunity to challenge the legitimacy of these guidelines, and we started an internal appeal to first the advisor, then the principal, and then it reached eventually all the way to the superintendent. After the dispute with the advisor over this cartoon, she resigned from her position. And under the new guidelines, we could no longer publish a paper with it because we didn't have an advisor, and the district did not immediately provide us with a replacement. So we were forced underground. The first of those issues, we reprinted the cartoon in an editorial about censorship. And on the basis of the reprint of the cartoon, the district denied us our request to distribute the March issue on school grounds. It took quite a bit longer for the appeal to finish working its way through the school district. But at the end, we got a letter from the superintendent denying both of our claims, denying that censorship of the cartoon was a mistake and upholding the guidelines. A local attorney offered to represent the paper pro bono in a legal struggle. So we took him up on it, and the district submitted their motion for summary judgment, and a few years later we get this response from the judge, and that brings us to today.
Well, let's talk about first, there was a threshold issue in the case that can be very important and sometimes decisive in student media cases, and that was whether there was even a case live anymore now that all the students involved have graduated. And the judge actually dealt with that and resolved it in favor of the students in this case.
Yes, that was what the district, that seemed to be the main crux of their argument for a long time, that the case was moot because we had graduated. And when we were students, we sort of had the suspicion that their strategy for dealing with the paper was just to wait until we graduated, because we were seen as, you know, a troublesome bunch, and if they just were able to wait us out, they'd be able to do what they wanted with the paper. So we were very pleased that the judge saw this as a problem that had the potential to recur, and that we were standing in for the interests of the paper.
Yeah, that was a very interesting point, and one that is a good point for others who find themselves similarly situated in a lawsuit to remember, and that is that these students not only were found to be representing themselves, but were found to be representing the interests of the paper and those who would come after them as editors. And so on that basis, the court turned aside the argument that the case was moot and then went on to decide the merits of the case. So let's talk just a little bit about first, I want to talk about the claim that has survived and that is scheduled to go forward for trial, and this trial may happen as soon as May. And that is the claim that challenges the constitutionality of these guidelines that were imposed in January of 2005. Can you talk a little bit about what was objectionable about the guidelines and why the students felt that their First Amendment rights were violated by this set of guidelines?
Well, they were offensive for a lot of reasons, the first of which has nothing to do with the text of them, but just that we were not consulted in their creation after being told before that, you know, there were these ideas that we would want to have guidelines that clarified the role of the paper, the role of the advisor, and we made it very clear that this was a good idea and that we would like to be involved. And so we were not told anything about these guidelines before they came into being, and as a result, even though the administration claimed that they were simply a codification of past practices, they had nothing in common with how the paper was run. And essentially, the guidelines transform the paper into little more than a mouthpiece for the administration. As you mentioned earlier, they require, you know, stories to be vetted before they're even written, and everything is subject to administrative review. And it seemed like under these guidelines, content could be cut for almost any reason, coming from a situation where students exercised full editorial control. Seeing these guidelines and imagining operating under them was incomprehensible.
Well, so that's the claim that the court has allowed to survive and has allowed to go forward for trial. But there were other claims in the case that the court granted summary judgment in favor of the school and has thrown out unless those are successfully appealed. And I want to talk a little bit about how the court reached that outcome because, again, this could be important for people bringing other similar types of claims in the future. One of the issues that the court dealt with in regard to the Tatler, the student paper, was whether the student paper was or was not a public forum for student expression. And the court came to the conclusion that the Tatler was neither a traditional public forum, that is, not a place that was thrown open indiscriminately for any member of the public to use for speech, but nor was it a non-public forum where speech could be foreclosed. It was, in the court's view, a limited public forum, meaning that it had been held open for use by the student editors for purposes appropriate to their role as student editors. No member of the public could just walk in off the street and insist on having an article printed, but it was certainly a public forum as regards the student editors. And that seems to me to be a correct determination and one that is in keeping with the history of the way the publication was run. Do you agree?
To be honest, I have very little idea of what a limited public forum meant. When I was doing all of this research in high school, all of the flowcharts seemed to go between Tinker and Hazelwood, and I had never really seen this analysis applied to a student newspaper. As you put it, that sounds more or less accurate. I was an editor, and I felt like I would exercise my judgment to represent the voice of the student body, but I didn't feel compelled to publish any particular person's, you know, as you say, guy off the streets writing. But at the same time, it was, you know, a paper set up for student editors to exercise editorial authority.
Right. The problem legally is once a court finds that a publication is a public forum, even a limited public forum, then that ought to foreclose going down the road of a Hazelwood versus Kohlmeier analysis. And Robert, you mentioned the Hazelwood case. So just to take a minute to fill people in on the background to that case, right? The Hazelwood case was a 1988 U.S. Supreme Court case which said that in the case of a student newspaper that is not operated as a public forum, that is, a student newspaper that's operated as the official spokesperson, the official mouthpiece, the official voice of the school, that newspaper can be censored as long as the school can tie the censorship back to some legitimate pedagogical justification. So it was a relatively low standard for a school to have to meet to justify its censorship. And what the court said was that it was possible for a school to operate a student paper as a public forum and not as a mouthpiece for the school. And where the paper operated as a public forum, the students would be entitled to the benefit of the Tinker level of protection. And the Tinker case, as we all remember, hopefully from civics class, says that students can't be censored unless their speech substantially disrupts the operations of the school. So that's a much higher threshold for a school to have to satisfy. Now, unfortunately, having made the finding that the Tatler operated at Ithaca High School as a limited public forum, the court went on and continued in any event to rely on the Hazelwood case. And it based in part on applying the Hazelwood case and applying some other Supreme Court case law, the court determined that there was no First Amendment violation either in the initial decision to prohibit the cartoon from running, or in the subsequent decision to prohibit the students from distributing an independently funded publication that contained a reprint of that same cartoon. And Robert, I would like you to address the second of those situations, that is the situation where you have an independently funded student publication. I'm assuming that you felt that when you were no longer writing in the quote-unquote official student newspaper, that you'd have the benefit of greater leeway and less oversight over your content, correct?
That was the understanding. Otherwise, we never would have reprinted this cartoon. We thought we were sure that it would be approved.
Yeah, and what happened when you wanted to distribute the newspaper? There was a requirement that materials be shown to the administration before they be distributed on campus, correct?
Yes.
Right, and based on their exercise of that review, the administrators denied the students the right to circulate the materials. So, did the materials ever get seen by the wider student audience?
Oh yes, that was one of our most widely read issues. We stood around just outside of school grounds handing them out, and it was a sort of amazing scene, seeing people who may never have read the paper before suddenly become interested in it and what was inside and learning more about these issues. It certainly reached the student population and beyond.
One of the solutions that the students were able to arrive at, to get their message out, was to simply physically distribute at a place that was no longer under the control of the school.
Right.
So that's also an interesting point for people who may find themselves in this situation in the future. And, of course, now we have online distribution, which many high school papers didn't have back in 2004, but we have that additional outlet. Robert, if this were to happen today, you think, at Ithaca High School and you were the editor, how might technology make the situation different?
Well, there were web pages back then, and we had a website, and we had discussed as early as the June issue that was canceled, maybe should we just put articles online? But we decided not to, and we felt that a newspaper had more relevance and credibility. So we decided that we would be able to, and we would be interested in publishing a newspaper. That's not to say that the technology hasn't changed. I think the ability to communicate through social networking sites really did not exist when we were students. And I do wonder how that might have changed our lines of communication with the student body.
Well, we talked about one way in which arguably the court's analysis deviated from accepted First Amendment principles. And I want to highlight a second one, which is the court's application of the 2007 Supreme Court case in Morse versus Frederick. Now, Morse versus Frederick is a case that, if anybody's ever heard of it at all, they've heard of it as the bong hits for Jesus case. This was a case of a student who held up a sign at a school-affiliated gathering across the street from school during a time when students were encouraged to assemble at this hillside across from the campus, and the sign said, "Bong hits for Jesus," and the principal tore the sign out of the student's hand and suspended him, and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court held there was no First Amendment violation in censoring that student's message, and the decision turned on the fact that, in the court's view, the student was encouraging the use of illegal drugs, and specifically the court confined its ruling to situations where speech encourages the use of illegal drugs. Well, this court in the Ithaca case has now extended the Morse ruling and has said that Morse also equally applies to allow schools to censor content that they believe encourages risky sexual behavior, that is, content that, in the court's view, undermines the effectiveness of school sex education programs. And that was how the court viewed this cartoon, and on that basis the court held that the Morse rule applies and that the school can censor that content. Robert, did you feel, as editor of the paper and in your discussions when you were deciding whether to print this cartoon, did you feel that it was undermining the effectiveness of the school's sex education programs, and do you think that's a legitimate basis on which to censor content?
Well, I have not yet been presented with a viable scenario in which the publication of this cartoon could possibly impact any sort of sex education or training. So we've never understood that claim fully. But even if it could, I didn't realize that sex was illegal. I don't know exactly how far this analogy can go, and how many views that don't happen to be the views held by administrators. Why, if these are not illegal acts, why is their discussion prohibited on school grounds? It doesn't seem like a very generous allotment of First Amendment protection.
Well, certainly, when you have disagreements over matters of legal interpretation, that's when cases get set up for appeal. And I gather, Robert, that there's some discussion of possibly appealing from the judge's order dismissing some of the claims in this case.
Yes, we're talking to our lawyer and evaluating all of our options, and we have not yet reached a decision on how to proceed from this ruling.
What sort of lessons, I wonder, would you take away from this? You've had a few years now to reflect on it. You're in college now at Cornell, and you've had the opportunity to relive this situation over and over again. Are there any tips or pieces of advice you might give to today's high school editors about managing a controversial situation like that?
I wonder about that sometimes, and most of the lessons I've gotten are very ambiguous, and I haven't figured out how to interpret them yet. Some of the wording in this decision, you know, seems to be implying a philosophy that you should sue early and sue often. It had censored us in the past, as I started off with the June issue, and we worked around it. But some of these decisions the school made earlier and some of the actions they took that, even though we disagreed with and felt they were illegal and reprehensible, we're worried that now that since we were able to work around them, it might actually hurt our case. I think there were parts of this ruling that seemed to say that since the school district had gotten away with censorship before, they showed that they had exercised some amount of control over the operation. And that was, I don't think, a good lesson for me to receive. It was an upsetting lesson for sure, because it undercut all of our discussions about working to a solution without the involvement of the court. And I think the biggest lesson is that it's most important for a school newspaper to stay in touch with the student population and stay tuned to it. If the district is or some administrators are trying to get in the way of the communication between the students and the paper, the editors must find a way to circumvent that and stay in touch with the student body. And if they can do that, then I don't think that any attempts to censor student speech will ultimately succeed, because, as you've mentioned, there are now so many ways for writing and imagery and publications to be distributed, that if you're saying something that's useful to people, there are ways to say it.
Well, we've been talking with Robert Oxhorn, the former editor-in-chief from the Ithaca High School student newspaper, who was the lead plaintiff in the case RO versus Ithaca City School District, in which the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of New York recently issued a decision dated March the 24th, granting in part and denying in part the motion for summary judgment by the school district and preserving at least one of the students' claims to go forward to trial. Thank you for joining us, Robert Oxhorn, and thank you for listening to the Student Press Law Center podcast for April 2009. Please check out our website for more information at www.splc.org. And if you're a student journalist or a journalism advisor with a question about your legal rights, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thanks for listening.